away with something, anything. Salesmen say always be closing. Dittmar's just wanted always to be putting something over on someone, anyone. But the first time Irving met Dittmar's, all he knew was that an arson investigator had him in his sights.
"Shame about that fire at your Dundalk property," Dittmar said, dropping heavily into the chair opposite Irving's desk.
"Yeah," Irving said, "a very sad situation."
"No, I mean, it's a shame it doesn't happen more often. Druggies, scum. The kind of people you never used to see in the county. But I guess that's changing."
Irving thought himself a cynical man, but arson investigator Burton Dittmar's was a new kind of hard.
"Do they know what started the fire?"
"Trash can fire. The front of the house is brick, but the addition on the back was wood. Guess I don't have to tell you the nature of the structure. Something as small as a burning cigarette butt could have done it." He almost yearned to correct this arrogant man, offer up cigar. Instead, "They had smoke alarms. My places are always up to code. But it's not on the landlord to check the batteries."
Dittmar's put his feet up on Irving's desk, knees bent, so Irving could see the tops of the shoes, which had a formidable shine. Irving could almost see his reflection in the toes.
"I got somebody you should meet," Dittmar said. "Somebody I think you should be in business with."
"I'm not sure. That your blue Buick out front?"
"His Buick."
There's no reason for Dittmar's to ask about his car. Unless someone saw him driving away.
Irving watched as his twin reflections nodded hesitantly, trapped in the bulbous ends of those shoes.
A week later, Dittmar's returned, this time with a quiet African-American man in khakis and a banlon shirt. Rail thin and sinewy, with close-cropped hair that was beginning to gray. He looked like a walking piece of jerky.
"Charles Coupe," he said.
"Like the car?"
"Like what you get on your medical insurance, only with a U."
He smiled.
"I'm talking your language, huh? I find that's important, to speak to a man in terms he understands."
Irving nodded. He had no idea what Coupe, was talking about.
"That fire in your rental in Dundalk. I lost an employee."
"I'm sorry."
"I'm not. He wasn't much good.
But now he's gone, taking with him all the time and energy I put into him. And I can't be compensated for that."
"Dittmar's, though, he told me you get a check because you own the building. You own this shitty row house with bum smoke alarms.
I put the alarms in. I can't help if they don't replace the batteries. You know what those people do. They hear the beeping and they disconnect them."
Coupe grinned and repeated, "Those people.
Tenants like that, I mean. How much was the place insured for?"
$50,000,
Irving said. "But I lose the income, don't forget. Nothing left but walls. I have to rebuild if I want to get the monthly income back. Frankly, I'm not sure it's worth it."
$50,000 for a row house that you rented for $325 a month without utilities. And you bought it for what, $18,000, $20,000?
Coupe's numbers were eerily on point.
Man, I'd buy all the row houses I could if I could get money back when they burned down.
Interesting conversation to be having in front of an arson investigator, Irving thought, but said nothing.
That young man who worked for me. He had children. Living with their grandmom, thank goodness, two kids. Daddy's gone. Mama's gone. Who's gonna provide for them?
Maybe you could start a fund or ask the church, but they won't get $50,000, will they?
I was thinking maybe the men who work for me should have life insurance. As a, what's the word? A perquisite. I'd like to start offering life insurance policies to my workers. They're young men in their 20s. Couldn't cost much. Do you understand what I want?
Irving understood. Dittmars knew he had set the fire. Dittmars had sold him out to Coupe. Could Dittmars prove anything? Probably not. But even an investigation would be disastrous for Irving, an insurance broker suspected of setting a fire in a building he owned. He could lose his license, and what would he be then, a full-time slumlord?
It can't always be a fire, he said.
It won't be, Coupe assured him. Mine is a dangerous business. Employee turnover is very high.
Irving found himself warming to the idea. These young men, trapped in a life from which they couldn't escape. Why shouldn't someone benefit?
You could change it up in other ways. You know what a viaticle is?
It's where the Pope lives.
That was Dittmars. Coupe wasn't the kind of man to lean into ignorance, to give answers when he wasn't sure if he was right.
Why don't you explain the finer points?
Charles Coupe, who, on paper, was a landlord not unlike Irving Lowenstein, became one of his best customers. He encouraged the young men who worked for him to get life insurance, with Coupe paying the initial premiums. Then, when they had trouble making the monthly payments, Coupe agreed to buy them back at 50 cents on the dollar. Half the time he didn't even have to arrange for the young men to die. The streets did it for him. And if the young men had the misfortune to suffer crippling injuries, he quietly canceled the policy. When he cashed in, he paid Irving 10% of whatever he made in cash, which Irving collected at Dittmars' house, usually on Friday nights when his wife thought he was at shul. Dittmars got 40%. Irving made a point of not asking him what he was paid for, but Dittmars liked to talk. He would sit at his kitchen table, his big voice booming about the fires he set, the lives he took. Irving told himself it couldn't be true, that he was just a braggart. But it was a relief when Pauline killed him. A relief, until Irving realized that she had played him. Getting that big insurance policy on a man she planned to kill, but making her kid the beneficiary so the payout couldn't be denied. That sparked the insurance commission investigation he had always feared, and he sweated 3 months, wondering if anyone would spot the pattern, all the claims collected by one Baltimore drug dealer. Then, Coupe got sick, colon cancer, and was dead within 4 months. Ironic, because he was a disciplined man, ate healthily, never smoked, certainly never dabbled in the wares that his people sold. Ironic, too, because he never took out a life insurance policy for himself. Irving almost missed him. But mainly he was glad to be out from under the sword of Damocles. The two people who knew his darkest secret were gone, and he was home free. The only person who knew they were in business together was Pauline. And she wasn't going to talk. In fact, Pauline, who was so quiet that a man could forget she was there, took a trick or two out of his book and wrote some new chapters. Somewhere, she has a jackpot waiting. And if she has money, he deserves some of it. She can give a little bit to him, or all of it to the state. Either way, she loses. And isn't that a way for him to win? It takes 25 minutes to get to his office, and that's despite knowing all the shortcuts. The strip center is his last commercial property. 12 stores, a parking lot, a wedge of Route 40 that gets a little seedier every year. His office is modest, as are his clothes, his car. But he paid cash to send his children to college, and he'll help to send his grandchildren to college, too. A widower for almost a year now, he's a catch, make no doubt about it. The single women at his synagogue, when he deigns to go, make eyes at him. But there was only one woman for him, and she's gone. And yes, one afternoon, for about 15 minutes, he thought a young Shiksa fancied him. He thought he was going to be her savior. He'll settle for being her ruination. Chapter 25. What are you thinking about? Polly asks Adam. They are in bed, looking at the ceiling. She's probably hurt because he doesn't feel like spooning tonight. But Polly would never say anything as needy as that. Polly doesn't push when a man retreats. She pulls back even further. She, too, is lying on her back, hands folded across her chest. Until she spoke, he assumed she was asleep. Her breath, since he rolled off her, has been steady and soft. She won't ask the question again if he doesn't answer. Polly seldom repeats herself. It's odd enough for her to ask what he's thinking. Adam is thinking about rice. More specifically, he is thinking about risotto. It's a tricky dish, in a place as thinly staffed as the Hi-Ho. But there's a variation that's particularly nice in the fall, with mushrooms and squash, lots of cheese and butter. But risotto requires too much attention in a kitchen where he has only one helper, Jorge, who also has to run the dishwasher, bust the tables. No, he doesn't want to add risotto to the menu at the Hi-Ho. But he would like to make it for Polly one night. Only when? The restaurant is closed Mondays. But the bar is open, and Polly has to work every day but Tuesday. Mr. C has brought in a new girl to help on Fridays and Saturdays, which continue to be semi-busy, but he's trying to get by without another full-time waitress until next summer. He doesn't believe the business will stay strong through the off-season. Adam doesn't either. Yet Polly has persuaded Mr. C to make subtle changes to the dining room. Nothing fancy. She's too smart to put lipstick on a pig. If anything, she's putting more pig on the pig, leaning into the jointness of the joint, playing up its retro features. The jukebox, long broken, has been refurbished, but Polly kept the tunes that were in there. So it's a nice little time warp, 1965 to 1985. She also got Mr. C to replace the tables and chairs, but with what appears to be an eclectic jumble of wooden and formica, and one, just one, metal-top table, practically the twin of the one she lost in the fire. Things are cleaner, brighter, but not too bright. It's hard to put a finger on it, but the Hi-Ho is now a place where people might like to linger. She has worked with the liquor supplier to find a few small, affordable wines to offer by the glass. Three reds and three whites. All Italian, very drinkable, good with food. How did you know about Vermentino? He asked her. You don't have to go to Italy to have tasted Italian wine, she says, a little affronted. I know, but... He stops himself from saying what he's thinking. But you're just a Dundalk girl. The farthest you've ever been from home is the beach. The beach or that women's prison in Frostburg. But she never told him where she served time. She never tells him anything about her past. Not since the last day in August. The day before the fire. when she presumably told him everything. Adam has been trying to assemble her life story on his own. He can't ask her because he's scared of screwing up, revealing that he knows things she's never told him. He doesn't want to ask Irving if there are other secrets he withheld when he hired Adam, because then Irving might figure out the extent of Adam's betrayal. But an old journalist friend has managed to pull together a pretty complete dossier on Polly Costello Dittmars Smith Hansen, whose current legal name is Pauline Smith Hansen. Married at 17, a mom at 21. The state has custody of that girl. Inevitable, given that her mother was in prison and the father was dead. Adam knows firsthand that she had another kid and abandoned her. She never speaks of her children, never. Sometimes he catches her with a sad, faraway look on her face, but who knows what that's about. She's mentioned that they could stop using condoms, but he keeps using them. She's insulted, suspicious. I can go on the pill. It's 99%. He says only, I don't think birth control pills are good for women. I won't tell you what to do with your body, but you should rethink all those hormones. God, he sounds like his own mother. But the world finally caught up with her, didn't it? A free spirit who may or may not have had a fling with Neil Cassidy, Lillian Bosk would now blend in comfortably with most suburban moms. Adam grew up eating good food, admiring his mother's painting, listening to his father play tenor sax. Work to live, don't live to work. That was his parents' motto. And yet, their son has somehow ended up putting in 14-hour days in a roadside Delaware restaurant whose main distinction is that it's too good for most of the people who eat there, but not good enough to get people to drive up from Salisbury or down from Wilmington. What's he gonna do? Get a Michelin star in Belleville, Delaware? There was a reason he left cooking behind after that season on the yacht. PI work also has its 14-hour days, but it pays much better. Then, there are the long fallow seasons when he travels. He should be in New Zealand or Argentina right now, watching the world edge into spring instead of fall. He should be alone. Except he can no longer imagine being any place without Polly. And this seems to be where she wants to be. He argues in his head, there's no money, Irving. There can't possibly be any money. No one with money would be here, in Belleville, in this garage apartment she found a week ago. She seems to love it. But would someone kill to keep this life? Did she kill Kath? Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, he says to his own thoughts. Then reaches for her hand. Did you say something? He asks. He's not even sure if she's still awake. When she replies, her voice is clear and measured, not the least bit sleepy, but also without the edge that most women use when asked to repeat themselves. She is capable of a stillness he has never found in another woman. Stillness. He thinks about hunting. Deer season will be starting soon. Do they have deer in Delaware? Is there a place for him to go and sit in a tree with his bow and arrow? Is there time? Tonight at work, doodling on a pad, he found himself sketching a stick figure being pulled underwater by an anchor. The anchor is the hi-ho. The anchor is this town, this life, but not Polly. Unless I asked what you were thinking about. Rice, he says. Chapter 26. Polly asks Adam to borrow his truck. Doesn't say why, doesn't offer to tell him where she's going. Let him show some curiosity. She has answers ready if he wants them. But he doesn't ask. He's terrified to ask her anything, she realizes. He can barely ask her, how are you? Or when they're eating breakfast, could you pass the butter? He thinks she's straight up murdered Kath.
Fine.
Yet he alibied her, agreed she had been at his door by midnight, which she was, give or take. She didn't ask him to, didn't need him to.
That's his problem. She has her own problems, which is why she needs his truck.
She's working 6 days a week, but her pocketbook would be hurting if she and Adam weren't splitting expenses on the garage apartment. Adam never seems to worry about money, though. That must be nice. Polly wonders if people who don't worry about money can ever understand what it's like, fretting over every dollar that leaves your hands. Even if they used to know those circumstances, they forget so quickly. It's like being hungry. You can't really remember it when you have enough food. You can't will yourself to feel it. You're hungry or you're not. You're poor or you're not. Today, for example, Polly has to think about how much gas his truck has, if she can afford to fill it, or at least buy a few gallons of gas after the trip. Adam, being Adam, he gives her the truck with a full tank, kisses her, and remembers to ask, "You gonna be okay? Going across the bridge?"
"I'm going up to Dover."
He doesn't ask why. She has a lie ready if he does. She's going to say she's taking her driver's exam, that she still has a birth certificate that identifies her as Polly Costello, so she should be able to do it pretty simply. A lie on so many levels, one he'll see through. Where'd she get her birth certificate if she lost everything in the fire? And again, one she has an answer for. Oh, you can write to the state of Maryland and request a copy. Of course, she can't become Polly Costello again until she divorces Greg. Even then, it's not automatic. She's going to have to go through the Social Security Administration to get her own name back. But Adam doesn't know all that. Adam, true to form, isn't asking her any questions. He does say, "You're getting an awfully early start." It's only 6, barely light, at this time of year. The early bird gets the worm. Place opens at 8, but I want to stop for breakfast. She's in Baltimore by 8:15, waiting near the corner of Harford Road, hoping that Greg won't notice the big pickup at the curb. Greg doesn't notice much. He's the kind of guy who can't tell when a woman has an orgasm. And not because the woman's faking it, all When Harry Met Sally style. Greg assumes it's happening. And if it's not, then it's not his problem. He thought their sex life was great. It was for him. She can see the edge of her house on Kentucky Avenue from where she's parked, but she can barely remember the woman who used to live there. That woman had been pretending to be so many things she wasn't, had disavowed her past. She is finally herself, Polly Costello. The old nickname, the surname she was born with. They were like some beautiful architectural feature in an old house, hidden by years of improvements. She has timed it right. Greg, who has to be at work at 9:30, pulls out at 8:55. She's pretty sure where he's going, so she hangs back as he drives north, then west. Yep, he's still parking Janny with his mother all day. Savannah Hansen must love that. She's the kind of grandmother who prides herself on how young she looks. Used to say things like, "There was this man in Belloc Diner who thought Pauline and I were sisters. Isn't that hilarious?" The guy was legit legally blind and just making polite small talk. Yet if Polly said that, she would be petty. She was expected to ignore Savannah's silly pride, her bizarre competitiveness. She doesn't risk getting too close to Savannah's house, so all she can see of Janny is her profile. Brave girl. Polly's not sure why that word brave pops into her head, but there's something so upright about this daughter. A little soldier marching on. She always knew Janny would be okay. Greg lifts her from her car seat and she walks up the sidewalk, her grandmother waiting in the open door. Savannah Hansen is wearing a sundress, way too short, tight, and bright. From there, Polly goes to see Joy. It's unclear how much Joy understands what she knows. But Polly never doubts that her daughter recognizes her. The staff lets them have 30 minutes alone. Joy's 14. And she won't be allowed to stay past her 18th birthday, at which point the state will have to find another placement for her. Soon, sweetheart, soon. But what is soon to Joy? How does Joy experience time? People thought time in prison moved slowly, and it did. Yet those days were no slower than Polly's days with Dittmar's, and much easier to pass. No fear, no lows, no highs, either, but that was okay. What is time like for Joy? Polly spells out, Mama, on Joy's board, and Joy spells it back. But what does it mean to her? The woman who's never there, who could never be there. Polly's final errand, the real business of the day, is to an office in Midtown Baltimore. It's a self-consciously hip place, especially for Baltimore, a converted firehouse. Of course, this guy kept the pole, which is at the center of the reception area. He probably makes jokes about it. Sure enough, when Barry Forshaw ushers her into his office, he says, How do you like the new digs? I kept the pole for dancing late at night. Want to give it a try? She can't even be bothered to show him how offensive that is. Look, I know you don't do marital law, but Greg is really dragging his feet now that we're separated. Is there any way I can make him file? You want a divorce? I thought you were concerned that he'd leave you if he knew about your past. Shit. She forgot that she told Forshaw that she wanted to keep the settlement a secret for now because Greg didn't know she had been married before. Or how it ended. It's not going to work out. I left him back in June. She lowers her eyes to her lap. There are... Well, I can't talk about it. If you left him, you have to wait for 2 years. 2 years? She can't believe it. Isn't there any way to make it go faster? He can file after 1 year from the separation citing abandonment. He has cause. You don't. Oh, she has cause. What would make him file? Christ, Pauline, I don't know. I never met the guy. Can you move the money to, what do you call it, like a Swiss bank account or something overseas? Offshore. I guess that could be done, but I'd have to charge you for it. How much more of my money do you want? I'm a lawyer. I charge for my time. You already have 40% of my settlement. Isn't that enough? I explain that. If you'd let me take it to trial, we were looking at a chance for a much bigger payout. You were the one who wanted a sealed settlement, and that's why the hospital was so eager to give you what you wanted. I could have made 2-3 million on my usual 30%. Instead, that's what we got total. And you can have your money whenever you want. If Greg knows about it, he'll try to take it. He can try, but he won't succeed. Look, I don't do marital law, but any half-decent divorce attorney can shield that money from him. I'm done paying lawyers, she says. I just want to get out of my marriage as quick as possible, no complications. I was going to go to Reno, but that's not going to work out. Fine, do it your way. There's an argument to be made, Pauline, that you're being penny-wise, but pound-foolish. Hire a divorce lawyer. An argument to be made. He has to think that. He's a lawyer. His livelihood depends on arguments having worth. She looks around his office. It's filled with antiques, stupid things that clearly mean nothing to him. Trophies purchased to celebrate cashing in on the misery of others. Babies with cerebral palsy because of botched deliveries. Steel workers with destroyed lungs, lives and bodies ruined by drunken drivers. Let me just ask you, as a man, if your wife walked out on you, left you with your kid, what would make you want to divorce her? If I met a new woman, maybe,
I don't know. Your husband probably thinks the divorce is going to cost him, so he's in no hurry to get started. Remember, he believes you're dead broke. Maybe if you tell him you want to marry again, then he'll think he'll have you over the barrel and he'll tip his hand, reveal what he wants. She smiles.
That advice is worth more than almost anything you've done for me.
No charge, he says, waving a hand.
Mr. Magnanimous.
We've both benefited nicely from our relationship. It was a lucky day for me when Irving Lowenstein referred you.
Another lie she has forgotten.
Irving used to bitch about this guy all the time to Dittmars, which is part of the reason she chose him. Anyone on Irving's bad side couldn't be all bad. She had used Irving's name, let Forshaw assume she was fond of nice old Mr. Lowenstein.
I probably should have sent him a gift, come to think of it, Forshaw continues.
When I ran into him last fall, he wouldn't even let me buy him a Diet Coke.
You ran into Irving.
But you didn't mention me, right?
Didn't have to.
All I did was say medical malpractice, and he figured out it was you. Besides, it was a referral. He knew he had recommended me to you, right?
Polly's nostrils fill with a scorching smell. But it's a memory. The pleasant smell of damp laundry as she presses Greg's shirts and watches television.
I'm Barry Forshaw, and I'm for the law, and for you.
Irving Lowenstein. Why had she used his name when she called this stupid ambulance chaser? Because she wanted to sound connected. She wanted to be more than what she was, a dumb housewife, watching soap operas and listening to some guy's Balmore accent bleeding from her television set.
Barry Forshaw is for the law and for you.
How did you find me? Barry Forshaw had asked her. All she had to say was television, but she thought that would mark her as naive, and to be naive was to be cheated, ruined, hurt. She said, I heard from Irving Lowenstein that you were a fighter. We go way back, Irving and I. And now, because Baltimore is so goddamn small, Irving has learned she hired Forshaw. Greg may not know she has money hidden away, but Irving does. She manages to smile, shake Forshaw's hand, walk out to Adam's truck. But she's shaking too hard to drive. She hadn't been completely stupid on that first visit, she thinks. It had been a test, dropping Irving's name. She needed someone just a little crooked, someone who would agree to pursue a settlement and keep it a secret. Someone who would then bank her money until she was free of Greg. Anyone who had done business with Irving had to be a little bent. So she had said Irving Lowenstein, and abracadabra, Barry had nodded, said he knew Irving, although mostly as an adversary. She remembers thinking that was good, that they were adversaries. He wasn't part of their schemes then. The schemes. She straightens up behind the wheel of Adam's truck, takes a deep breath. She's not shaking anymore. There may be a way to solve the Irving problem. Irving's not stupid. If Barry thanked him for referring Polly to him, he'll have figured out she has money. And he'll come after it.
I have 100% of the risk, but only 40% of the money, Dittmars used to lament. Irving takes 10% for doing nothing. But don't ever try to jip him out of his 10%.
Last fall, Forshaw says. He ran into Irving last fall. The mystery is why Irving hasn't made a move on her yet. Or maybe he has. She bangs open the glove compartment, decides she has time to run one more errand before heading east.
Chapter 27. I think I saw Pauline, Savannah Hansen tells Greg when he comes to pick up Janny.
Late.
He's 30 minutes late, and there might be beer on his breath.
You're always saying that.
Not always, sometimes. Maybe 3 times during the summer.
She frowns at a grubby chocolate handprint on the skirt of her yellow plaid sundress, which is brand new. The pattern reminded her of that cute outfit that the lead girl in that new movie wore. Savannah is in very good shape for her age, for any age, really. She doesn't exercise, but she watches what she eats, always has, ever since Greg's father walked out on them when Greg was not even a year old. She still had some of the pregnancy fat when Curtis left her, which was her fault. Savannah has always been very honest with herself. She let herself go, got sloppy and whiny, and Curtis wasn't having it. Some women in her situation would have been bitter, but Savannah found strength in seeing what she had done wrong. Being bossy was okay. Men secretly liked bossy, in her experience, but not naggy and self-pitying. And you can be bossy only as long as, at the end of the day, your man knows he's the king of the castle, the cock of the walk. She raised Greg to expect nothing less. Go figure. That mousy Pauline would be his undoing. Janny is asleep, and Greg hoists her to his shoulder with a kind of absent-minded tenderness. She's a beautiful girl, but then Janny favors her father. No conceit there. Greg is a pretty boy. The one thing that Savannah and Curtis did right, with those dark curls and pale blue eyes. Once Curtis left, Savannah never lacked for male companionship. But when the men figured out that Greg was always going to be number one, they didn't want to play second fiddle. She didn't care. She didn't need him. Curtis was good about money, if not much else. She got to raise her boy the way she wanted, which was to be all man. The way Savannah saw it, if you treated a man right, he could afford to be benevolent, generous. It's only when you pick at a man's power that he turns mean. She was so disappointed when he brought Pauline home. And not fooled for a minute. She knew the girl, woman, in her 30s already, although she was trying to play it younger, was knocked up the moment she saw her. It was the only possible explanation for the swift marriage down at the courthouse, never mind all that talk about the honeymoon. 8 months later, Janny proved Savannah right. She would have rather been wrong. Not that she doesn't love Janny, dote on Janny. But she wasn't ready to be a grandmother yet. She was too young, barely 50 when Janny was born. Once the cashier at the Belloc Diner even asked if she and Pauline were sisters. Oh, Pauline was insulted, but it was right after Janny was born, so she was looking a little puffy and exhausted. Girl, Savannah had told her, meaning to do nothing but good. Don't do what I did. Don't let yourself go. Your man is job number one.
Really? Then why did you let your man go?
Oh, she had a mouth on her when Greg wasn't around. She was full of sass. That Pauline.
I didn't let him go. But when he left, I admitted it was my fault.
Savannah has to give Pauline credit. She starved that baby weight off her. Fact is, she went too far. She wasn't meant to be skinny, Pauline. In a bathing suit, she had those telltale silvery tracks, the sign of a big weight loss at some point. Oh, well, Savannah Hansen's one baby daycare center is closed for today. She's going to make herself a Kahlua with a splash of skim milk, then have some lean cuisine manicotti while she watches entertainment tonight. The woman she saw today, parked across the street in a truck, Savannah was pretty sure it was Pauline. But as Greg says, it's not the first time lately that she thought she saw her. And why would Pauline be driving a big truck like that? Maybe when you fear something, you see it hiding around every corner. And Savannah has always had an uneasy feeling around Pauline. That look she gave her, when the man at the Belloc said they could be sisters. She is not a woman who will tolerate rivals, Savannah thinks, adding some ice cubes to her drink. Which is a problem, because Pauline is always going to have rivals. It's not her looks. It's her lack of confidence, pure and simple. She already has a rival in Janny,
Oh, and now come to find out that she had a past. Greg told Savannah that he found out this summer that Pauline was that woman who killed her husband and lied about it. Something like that. Savannah went all over cold hearing that. Imagine her sweet son lying in bed next to that woman. Thank God they're getting divorced. They better be getting divorced. Savannah puts her feet up on her hassock. Her just-so house is beginning to look a little worse for wear. It's no place for a sticky toddler. Much as it pains her, Savannah has to put Greg on notice that this is a temporary arrangement. She loves her grandchild, but she didn't sign up for another round of this everyday shit. She has served her time. Chapter 28. A song plays in Adam's head as he looks at the gas gauge on his truck. Where did you go, my handsome Polly-O? Half full. That's consistent with a trip to Dover. Only, the odometer isn't. The truck is turned over to 13,000 miles, which means she traveled more than 200 miles yesterday. Did she really think he wouldn't check the mileage? Yes, you sick fuck, because she thinks you believe every word she says, which means she either trusts you or she's playing you for a fool. In which case, yes, you dumb fuck. Either scenario, he's hosed. If she loves and trusts him, he could never reveal to her the real reason they met. And if she's playing him, he'll end up another chump, abandoned at best. This much is clear. Polly returned from wherever she was in a mood that is new, at least to him. It's as if she's changed her hair color, but by no more than a shade. Always self-contained, she now carries the air of someone with a secret, a pleasant one. She smiles without seeming to be aware of it, hums in careless moments. They get up, go to work, come home, make love. Everything is the same as it was. Or is it? It takes him a few days to pick up on the changes. She doesn't read the real estate ads anymore. Strange. He used to hate seeing the paper lying on the table, the house ads circled in bright blue marker. But now that she's stopped, he feels unnerved. Why has she stopped planning for the future, their future? She no longer talks about B&Bs, or what the hi-ho could be in the hands of an ambitious young couple. She doesn't push him to add new dishes to the menu. She doesn't brainstorm about specials or theme nights. In bed, she is more passionate than ever. Where did you go, my handsome Polly-O? What do you know, my handsome Polly-O? Polly-O. His mother had sung that old folk song to him in her off-key yet pleasant warble of a voice. She had an auto harp. Of course she did. And once again, the world has caught up to his mother, with people going crazy for this album by a pretty young bluegrass artist. When Adam was young, he hated his parents' music, but then teenagers are supposed to hate their parents' music. Does it still work that way? If he had a kid, how could the kid dare to say no to The Clash and The Pogues and Elvis Costello? The kid would have to tie himself in knots, making a case against the musicians Adam loved in his teens and twenties, still loves. But the next generation would do it, if only out of sheer perversity. God, the shit on the radio now. Those awful boy bands built on a formula as old as the Monkees, a cute one, a brainy one, a quirky one, an ugly one. He is cleaning up after a slow Wednesday, although business had picked up a bit when early diners reported around town that he was serving chicken casserole. The dish was, more accurately, a chicken lasagna, made with heavy cream and about 4 pounds of cheese. It tickles him, he has to admit, when he gets a burst of locals late in the shift because word has traveled about how good tonight's special is. But it reminds him, too, what life in a small town is like. There are three or four families who matter, at least in Belleville. There's one in particular whose name is on everything, the Langleys. They were here tonight, swanned in like the king and queen of homecoming, their loyal court in attendance. But their approval matters, and he slaved over their plates as if the New York Times restaurant critic were out there. No, the small-town life is not the life for him. Which sounds like another song his mother might have sung. How he misses his parents. Those sad, sweet hippies who ate macrobiotic, smoked dope, and died before they were 60. A heart attack for him, a stroke for her. Because some people do everything right and still don't catch a break. And maybe that's Polly, he thinks, looking at her, closing down the register at the bar. Maybe she just had shitty luck all these years. He watches her count the cash. She's so loving with the money. It's as if every bill is a child on its way to school, each one needing a last loving touch. A cap adjusted on this one, a smear of toothpaste wiped from the corner of that one's lips. She is especially solicitous of her tips, tucking them into her billfold snugly. Why aren't you tucking your own child into bed at night, handsome Polly-O? Where did you go, my handsome Polly-O? And maybe, because his thoughts keep going to music tonight, or maybe because she's swaying a little, as if lost in a private dance, he goes over to the jukebox and drops a quarter in. He doesn't want to agonize over a pick, so he punches in a random combo, AA11. He knows the song from its first notes. I'd like to get to know you. 1968, a deeply uncool song. But he was 11 in 1968. He would have killed to slow dance with a girl to this song, to any song. He turns and opens his arms to her, and she doesn't have to be asked. Oh, how I love you, quiet Polly-O, with all your secrets and silences. They move through the restaurant as if it were a ballroom. Jorge comes out of the kitchen to watch, then disappears as if he's caught them fucking. Their dance is that private, that intimate. I'd like to get to know you. He would. He wants to know her, and he wants her to know him. He was hired to get to know her. Those were his literal marching orders. Get to know her, Irving had said. Insinuate your way into her life. Look for inconsistencies. Is she living large in any way? I need to figure out if she's tapped into the money, or if it's out there somewhere waiting for her. We have to get to her before she wastes that poor child's money. She's done this before. She and her husband used me to run a very sophisticated insurance scheme. He realizes now that Irving planned to blackmail Polly. He thought she would pay to keep her safe new life, that she would be terrified of her husband knowing about her past. When she bolted, he lost his leverage. But it's also evident now that Adam was working for a bad guy, had worked. He ended the relationship the Tuesday after Labor Day, told Irving that he clearly wasn't going to be able to deliver the information Irving wanted. The proof that she even had money, much less where she was keeping it. Adam hadn't started out to work for a bad guy. He thought he was on the right side. He had been told that a woman had stolen money from her stepdaughter. When Adam had confronted Irving with his lies, he seemed to shrug, said he always thought the girl was a stepdaughter because Polly had been so unloving with her, so distant. And after all, she had in fact murdered her husband. Was it so wrong to think she was capable of screwing over her own daughter? She did kill a man. That's not up for debate. What if this woman, in his arms, killed Kath? Set that fire? Did she know that the volunteer fire department would be easy to fool? Or did she simply take the risk? But why would she kill Kath when Kath had no power over her? How had she lured her there? By the time Kath died, Adam and Mr. C knew about Polly's past. What more could there be?
I'd like to get to know you.
Sing it, Spanky, sing it. Polly's eyes are closed, her head on his shoulder. They dip and swoon through the restaurant. And when the song ends and the jukebox is silent, they stand there a long time, swaying to the songs in their heads.
Chapter 29. Polly has taken to slipping out of bed before the sun rises and walking to the Royal Farms for coffee, a little downtime with the Wilmington News Journal. She needs solitude, and that's no longer available to her at home. After the explosion, she was too dazed to consider what it would be like to live with Adam. They were a couple. She was confident of his love for her. It made sense for him to stop paying for the motel when she got the larger place. But now she's almost never alone, and she realizes how much she craves solitude, a luxury she didn't know until this summer. Even when Adam is sleeping, his presence fills the garage apartment. That used to be comforting. Like sleeping next to a lion. She felt safe. Now she notices that he snores a little. Sometimes even passes gas. He is, after all, a man. Kinder to her than the other men she's known. But still a man. Always a man. The new place is, by almost anyone's standards, nicer than the one above the Ben Franklin. Modern appliances, 1.5 baths. And most people would probably like the wooded backyard, the privacy it provides. But Polly misses the light that filled her second-floor apartment, the high ceilings and almost empty rooms. Even if most of the things in the new place belong to the landlord, the same landlord she had before, giving her a break. He feels terrible about the explosion, Kath's death. They weigh her down. In the Royal Farms, there is nothing to clean, nothing to cook. Not even a cup to rinse after she's finished her coffee. She leaves the newspaper behind for whoever sits down next. The News Journal doesn't really mean anything to her. She might as well be reading a paper in a foreign language. The towns, the counties, the elected officials. She doesn't recognize a one. The only thing she knows about Delaware is Belleville. And the only time Belleville was in the News Journal was when Polly's apartment blew up and Kath died. They mentioned her, of course, but no one cared. It was an accident, after all. That beautiful old stove, she thinks with a pang. There was even a little backfire of gossip, that maybe it was Kath who started the fire, but didn't realize how much gas had built up from the leaking stove. It makes as much sense as anything, Polly supposes, but she keeps a polite silence when Max and Ernest try to bait that hook. Best not to speak ill of the dead. But maybe those rumors are sturdy enough to travel on their own, because here's Kath's brother-in-law, Trooper Jim, waiting in his official car when Polly leaves the Royal Farms just before sunrise.
May I speak to you?
He asks. I need to get home. Adam doesn't like waking up alone. It's really quite endearing.
It won't take a minute.
He leans over, pushes open the passenger side door. She climbs in, but she doesn't close the door. She doesn't like being in confined spaces with people she can't trust, male or female. Her body is angled so she can move quickly if he tries to grab her.
You can close the door.
I know. He takes her measure, sees she won't be bullied, lets it go.
So, I've been talking to an arson expert, guy who testifies in trials. He says there's a scenario where it would make sense if someone made that explosion look like an accident in order to cover up a murder.
She says nothing. Dittmars told her a long time ago never to talk to anyone about anything.
If there was a fire and the gas was on, yes, it could go like that, kaboom. And if Kath lit a cigarette, maybe, assuming the gas had been leaking for a while. But the scene is consistent with what would happen if a small fire started in another room, say, from a candle.
or a scarf slipping and falling on the bare bulb of a bedside lamp.
Never tell anyone anything.
Dittmar's whispers in her ear. She never thought she'd be happy to hear his voice in her head. His voice is forever trapped in her head, but it's usually taunting, not helping.
But if the stove had been leaking for a while, you would have smelled it, right? You said you left to take a walk, then went to your boyfriend's motel room.
I often take walks at night. Nothing specific, nothing that can be contradicted.
But, you know, cigarette fiend that Kath is, she's pretty polite. She never would have smoked in someone else's home.
She lit up a cigarette in my kitchen the first time she came by, even though I asked her not to. And she used the burner.
Yes, the first time she came by.
So,
how many times was it that she dropped in to see you?
Remember, I'm the one she asked to check you out, so don't try to sell me on the friend thing.
Her fault. She has said too much.
That doesn't mean she has to keep talking.
Dittmar has taught her that, too. You can shut up any time. The sooner the better.
If she didn't scream or cry, the things he did to her, they didn't last as long.
Anyway, it could be arson. Trooper Jim continues. The investigation isn't necessarily closed, just so you know. A murder case never goes away. Who knows what kind of technology they'll have in 5-10 years? Kath's death has completely fucked up my in-laws. Finding who's to blame may be the only thing that will help them.
Closure, she says. Polly thinks about an investigation that had haunted Dittmar's, if only briefly. An accident on Christmas Day, in what would be the last full year of their life together. A family that had yearned for an old-fashioned Christmas had been foolish enough to use candles on the tree. But it was a gas leak that made the fire fatal, a fireball shooting up into the sky over Woodlawn. Walking through the wreckage where an entire family had died, Dittmar's had a vision. He wanted, briefly, to be a better person. He swore he was going to change, made a resolution to stop drinking. 3 days into the new year, he beat her with a belt, then wrapped it around her neck during sex. 6 weeks after that, there was a fire strangely similar to the Christmas Day one, only in the city.
So you know about my first husband?
Some.
Do you know everything?
He's dead. Why are we talking about him? Polly studies the sun as it rises. There's a stripe of orange-red, a low simmer on the horizon, then a perfect round lozenge suddenly popping up. She has never known sunrises and sunsets like they have in Belleville. The flat, open landscape gives the light so much room to spread. My husband was a dirty cop. He was an arson investigator. He knew how to make things look like accidents. He never, his words, shat where he ate. He worked for the county. But there were fires in the city, deadly ones, from time to time. And I'm pretty sure he set them.
He's dead, Trooper Jim repeats.
Polly wonders for a moment, is he?
How can she be sure?
It turns out it is possible to have seen a man's body, a knife sticking through his heart, and still wonder if one will ever be free of him. She can't believe she won. And yes, she considers killing Dittmar as a victory. She lost almost every battle in the years they were together, but she won the war. She won that war. And she'll win this one.
He had a partner, Irving Lowenstein. He arranged for policies. They split the proceeds.
He probably suspects I know things, insurance fraud, even murder. He has reasons to want me dead.
Are you trying to say someone was trying to kill you and killed Kath by accident?
I'm saying it's a possibility.
I'll need more than your say-so. Dates, names.
I can get them.
Chapter 30. June pours tomato soup into bowls, puts out goldfish crackers that she bought at the Food Lion on her way to her parents' house. "Please eat," she urges her mother. When Dorothy Dodo Whitmire retired from her job at the state school board, her plan was to start golfing with her husband, pursue her interest in birding, which had been limited to what she could see from their deck. Now she is hunched and ashen, as if she has lived years in the dark, immobile. June's father, Dan, never much of a talker, is almost completely mute these days, and he has lost so much weight that his face looks like melted rubber. Since Kath's death, June has tried to visit her parents at least one or two evenings a week. They are only in their late 50s, but the loss of their oldest daughter has aged them. Cruelty on top of cruelty. It doesn't help that they had both taken early retirement, which has ended up giving them